Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
I'm Lou Bank.
I am Chapariwan.
And this is Agave Road Trip. It is the critically acclaimed award-winning podcast that helps Green Gags bartenders better understand agave spirits in rural Mexico.
Okay.
So last week, Chava, which was really just a few minutes ago for us, last week we talked, it's funny, I have it listed as we bickered about. We didn't really bicker. We kind of agreed on everything.
I think we just had different parts of the narrative. How about that?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Yeah, we have different parts of the puzzle.
Yeah, so last week we talked about different parts of the puzzle as so to hard. Whether or not mezcal is sustainable and what it means to be sustainable. But, you know, I think the bigger and more important question is anything sustainable?
How about rephrasing? What about rephrasing that? I'm saying, do we have any other industries that we can learn from?
Huh? Do we have any? Well, you know, so yes, of course we do. We can learn from every industry, but. Does it still make that industry sustainable? Is there any model that anyone would be able to honestly claim is 100% sustainable?
Can I make a little bet?
Sure, Chava. Is this another 5 peso bet?
It is a 5 peso. That is as much money
are
as
you
I
tracking
bet.
All of our 5 peso bets?
No, but I was talking with my father. I had breakfast with him about betting. Yeah. And he once lost a full year of money playing the cards. So he says that was a tough lesson to learn.
So betting is not sustainable.
It is not. Clearly it's not. I mean, he was in his 20s. He would live in a small town, didn't have much to spend his money on. So it's fine. It was fine.
A year.
Wow. He didn't like it. No, he didn't speak with it in good spirits. But anyways, I think that maybe one of my favorite, and probably people are so bored about me always using textiles as the one industry that I think can do things.
I don't know about people, but I sure am. But keep going.
Yes, I know. So I believe textiles, when done with well-sourced cotton or fibers, I mean, even textiles made with agave fibers, if you wish, and that are being dyed with natural dyes in a certain scale, can be a great model. The thing that makes textiles such a great thing, I believe, or like really high quality textiles a great thing, is that they can last you a lifetime. So your impact can be tiny because you're buying something that you're going to be owning for the next 40, 50 years, and you're not creating that impact again in that amount of time. The problem with alcohol is that we drink it, and that a bottle... And depending who you are, that bottle may not last that long.
Even so tiny sips, even tiny sips add
even
up to
through
a
tiny
bottle.
Sips, those bottles go away.
Well, you know, it's funny, Chava, that you bring that up because, in fact, there was this article in 750 Daily a year or so ago, and the title of it is I've got it pulled up here, and we'll link to it in the on the episode page. But the title is "Climate Friendly Spirits Production is Possible. These distilleries are demonstrating how," and so they profile a handful of distilleries that that appear to be lowering carbon footprints, but so the big highlight of this particular article is where'd my notes go? The highlight of the article is this distillery called Appalachian Gap, and they are located in a town in Vermont where Connie and I happened to be vacationing over 4th of July last year because our friend Rob, shout out to Rob, I won't say his last name. He hates it when I say his last name, where our friend Rob lives. So I happened to wander in and I was able to talk to one of the owners and get a good quote from him about what makes his distillery what they consider a model for sustainability.
Okay, sure, please.
Okay.
One of the big basic issues you have with the distillery is what do you do with the waste? Because one of the things you can do with the waste, in some distilleries they do this, is you just flush it down the drain.
Right.
The problem is a distillery our size is roughly equivalent to a town flushing the toilet in terms of the waste impact on the waste treatment plant. So you have to divert it somehow. What a lot of distilleries in Vermont do is they send it to farms and they spread it on fields and things like that. What we do is that we have it trucked to a local anaerobic digester company that also accepts beer and from breweries and grain from breweries, and they convert it to methane, I believe, and then they immediately burn the methane to generate natural gas or to generate electricity from the methane. If I understand their process perfectly, I know that it's being used for energy, but I basically know anaerobic digestion, but I'm not a real expert.
I love this so much.
Right. So that was Chuck Birkins, one of the owners of Appalachian Gap.
Okay. So I do have a full argument about this. So I think that thinking about isolated industries having the capacity to regenerate their environments or to be less offensive to their environments is actually the wrong way to go about this.
Whoa.
And
wow.
Yeah.
Hang on. Left turn I did not expect. Okay.
No. I'm going to come back to this. Actually, do you remember that I used to work at an industrial park in Oaxaca?
Yeah, which is a very funny phrase in and of itself, industrial park. It's like trying to, like, talk about greenwashing. Now that's greenwashing. It's not a park. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah, but it's Oaxaca 2000. So progress is the future. Oaxaca 2000. yeah, I loved it. But there was no industries there. I mean, it was really broken. I used to call it the industrial jungle. But back in the day, we used to write a bunch of applications for research and whatnot. And one of the fantasies that I decided to pitch to an award, it was like a design award. It was like, usually people talk about industrial parks as this horrible thing that happens outside of the cities, right? Nobody wants to live close to an industrial park because the most polluted, ugly, smelly part of a city. But if you're able for a bunch of the industries to talk to each other in terms of processes, so the waste of the distillery becomes the methane for the glass blowing, and then the exhaust heat from the glass blowing becomes the energy for the distillation, and you start creating all these chains in which everything fits of each other, you could actually use the industrial park as a huge water filter. You could use the industrial park as a huge production of energy. You can use it as a very positive muscle, if you wish. So I think that one of the biggest problems that we have right now and why a bunch of the industries are very offensive is because they're not talking with each other in terms of their production. their waste is waste, and it's not being fed to somebody else that can convert that it's exactly by them.
Okay, but yeah. Well, I don't understand then why you dislike that quote, because that quote
No. I know what I am saying is that this is like an example of that. The fact that they have to truck it far away, that could be rephrased in a so it's not every,
okay.
They're all not neighbors feeding of each other.
You like what they're doing. You just want everything to be closer, because that makes it that actually makes it more sustainable.
And I want more points of contact. What if their distillery could be working out of part of that methane? So you have everything concentrated in a little bit of an island where everybody's energy and everybody's waste is talking to each other.
You know, I get what you're saying, but I think that in essence, even what you're suggesting is not sustainable, because you're still talking about the creation of stuff to be trucked from the place and sold somewhere else.
Well, and that's where it gets, I mean, when you are evaluating how offensive something is, it's a case by case scenario. So maybe, and again, like I'm starting to get more interested in the term regenerative than is sustainable, because I think that it's easier to measure in a way. Basically, with regenerative, it's like, is the area where you are standing and where you're producing thriving because you are producing something? Are you making more hectares of land have more biodiversity because you are there? It's basically, are you contributing to what is around you?
Well, okay. I get that. And I believe me, I mean, you don't have to look further than the projects we're doing at Sacred to understand that I believe that it is good to do that on that land. But if you're doing that, and yet the result is that the land a mile away is screwed up, or 10 miles or 100 miles is screwed up as a result of what you're doing. You know, so here's a quote from the University of Texas, right? From a case study. And I think it speaks to why I don't think you can just look at the land around you and talk about regeneration, right? So the quote is, it takes about 20 gallons of water to make a pint of beer. And Constellation, that's Constellation Brands, predicts it will use 396 million gallons annually, the same amount it would take to supply more than 14,000 people with running water. Currently, 300,000 Baja Californians live without regular access to water, and nearly 6% of households lack running water.
Well, you're saying what I am saying—that it's their immediate neighbors, Lou.
No. But what I'm saying is, so let's say Constellation says, "Well, we're going to go ahead and put some money into making this place look beautiful, right?"
Well, like what they have to do, it's like, how can we have access to, like, okay, so water doesn't just come from anywhere. If they have forests, if they have more mountains with more trees that have more capacity of retaining water, if you create a whole program in which you are the creator of the water you might be able to use, that is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, but you're still talking
you have capturation systems.
You're still talking 132 million gallons of beer? It's got to be more than that, actually. But like, so you're talking 132 million gallons of beer is what it says here, right? A year. And and where is it going? And how is it getting there? And what is it doing to the water supply
Of course. And that's why I believe that in these things, you have to be, I mean, it's super, I mean, if it was easy, we would have solved this a long time ago. But
well,
you have to be dissecting and integrating all the time. You have to be able to look at specific, okay, let's look at water, right? So let's say, where did they build their factory in order to source the water? Did they build it in a place where they could get a very deep well and they knew they were going to have 5 years of water, even if they were allowing for everybody around them not to have water? Or did they build their factory by a mountain that if they know that if they keep in very good shape, that's going to be their source of water for the next 200 years? That is the mind shift that I think it's important. And then it's also, and this is so hard for contemporary industry, and honestly, I think it's an unsolvable situation sometimes because growth is king. But when do you decide that you, if you keep on expanding in that specific place, you are incapable, even if you have the best scientists, the best mm-hmm. engineers, the best mm-hmm. intentions, everything yep. is going great. There's always a limit. There's it's always funny. A limit where, you know, like I put this many, this mountain is the healthiest mountain. It's sequestrating this amount of water. I still, you, if I go past this, like you, doesn't make
you
sense.
You just circled back around to make the argument that you argued against in last week's episode.
Which one?
Where you, like, smaller actually is better. Is in essence what you're saying, that the smaller operation is more sustainable.
What I am saying is you have to be able to know which is the limit. It's not about small or medium or big. It's about knowing what is the right size for the right environment.
Right, and how do you tell that from the outside? Smaller is better.
In essence, it's Sergio's project in Ultramundo.
Yeah.
He has 10,000 hectares. He can responsibly harvest 80% of what he has at hand every year.
Is what they think.
Is what they think. That's not small, Lou. I'm sorry, but that is not small.
The estimate is it's about 30,000 liters a year.
So that is an example of medium, if you wish, in the mezcal context.
Sure.
And that is responsible. Now, if he had 100,000 hectares, mm-hmm. that's 300,000 liters, uh-huh. and that's big. I get that,
but you and I know that because we've seen the land and we've had the conversation with Sergio. We know that it's not marketing bullshit. My point is, from the outside, as a consumer, you are safest going with small because small, well, they're not taking a lot of water from one place.
But ceramics, when they used to use lead. So one of the most polluting industries in the suburbs of Oaxaca for the quality of the air of Oaxaca. Uh-huh. I mean, I love them with a passion, but it was the ceramicists in Atsompa because uh-huh. all their glazes had uh-huh. lead.
Yep.
Tiny family operation, heritage production of ceramics, all the right things for someone from the outside to say, yes, these are the good guys. And they just had one element in their production that make them extremely offensive, even as being small.
I get it, but that's sort of my point.
I mean, you've heard about black widows, right, Lou? Small insect kills a big body.
Sure, yes, I get that. But that's my point, is none of this is easy. None of this is easy. In fact, I think the only answer to this, if you really want to just support sustainable, is become a subsistence farmer.
Oh, right, Lou, come on. No.
Yeah.
I think
the only true way to be sustainable, farmer.
I hate that conclusion with a passion. The right way to do this, it's find more projects that understand where they're standing, the amount of resources that can be used in that ecosystem while giving back to them, mm-hmm. and that are not crossing that line. How do you know that? Yes, very hard. I mean, we're lucky
And how many resources do you burn up finding those projects?
Burn up like how, like your brain cells?
In other words, I talk about our well, that too, but I talk about the carbon wake that you and I leave when we go on these agave road trips. Like we expend a lot of resources to go and meet guys like Sergio to see those projects.
Yeah, but I'm not a huge fan of this over-the-top Puritan approach of I need not to do anything because
Clearly, I'm not either because we go on agave road trips.
Okay. So,
and I'm not a subsistence farmer. I live in Chicago.
Okay, and what I am saying is, I've seen this. I've seen people that have beautiful, luscious lives that are, I think that your really ugly, horrible, not enjoyable HM t-shirt is far more destructive than the beautiful textiles made with agave fibers that you can find in one of these towns. And
I know, but it's still a compromise because you're having to drive to the town. Like this is
yeah. But what I am saying is that H&M ugly shirt that you're getting is creating political distress in Kenya because of, like its impact. It is just like so beyond your capacity to touch. Like it's a black widow. It's like it can kill an elephant. The venom of that little thing can kill an elephant. And then these other things is more like a dog with a flu. You know, it might make you feel bad for a few days, but it's not the end of the world. So I think, you know,
if you've got to make a choice, and you do have to make a choice.
Otherwise, it's impossible to live.
So, okay, sure. Which is exactly my point. Like, is... Unless you're going to become a subsistence farmer, you're going to make compromises.
Yes, but this, I really hope
that doesn't mean like, oh well, screw it. If you can't do anything, go ahead and get that H&M t-shirt. That's not what I'm saying, but I am saying recognize that you're making a compromise and try to do the best you can and try to give back where you can
and there's just stuff that it's over the top offensive, like the water situation in Monterrey right now connected to the beer. I mean that's obscene. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so when you are in face with such obscene situations, I will be like, okay, like maybe you don't want to drink Tecate, right? Like, you know, when you see like such strong indicators of someone being so fundamentally wrong, they're mm-hmm. so close to you, I might be, you know, cheering for people to stop supporting with their money that. But yeah.
Well, now you've just blown our Tecate sponsorship. Thanks, Java.
I said Tecate, not Tecate Light, Lou. Only Tecate Light will sponsor us.
Nice. Okay. Well, I think that's a wrap for this second part of our three-part sustainability miniseries,
and
Java.
If you're not sad and ready to never hear us again, kudos to you.
Right. And go drink something made, not small, but made with best practices.
Okay. Adios, joven Lou.
Hasta Bye. Pronto.
This has been Agave Road Trip, the podcast that helps gringo bartenders learn about agave spirits. Your hosts are Lou Bank and Chava Periban. Sound engineering by Roy Sierra. Theme song performed by Gabriel Oliveira and Mark Rico. Sign up to become a road tripper and listen to more episodes at agaveroadtrip.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please let us know. And if you hated it, recommend it to your enemies. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Lou is in charge of our social media, so if he happens to sound like an old man, forgive him. He is one. Agave Road Trip is a production of 10 Angry Pitbulls, Inc.
Agave Road Trip is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. To subscribe to the Heritage Radio Network newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with Heritage Radio Network on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find Heritage Radio Network at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. Heritage Radio Network couldn't do that without support from listeners like you. Become a part of the food world's most innovative community today. Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the Heritage Radio Network family by becoming a member. To become a member of the Heritage Radio Network, click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Heritage Radio Network can become addictive. Programming you hear on Heritage Radio Network can drive you to eat, drink, and listen to more programming on Heritage Radio Network. If it drives you to drink, please do not drink and drive. Drink responsibly. Eat responsibly too, and listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly. To listen to Heritage Radio Network responsibly, wear protective earbuds. While wearing protective earbuds, do not drive or walk. Sit in a comfortable chair. If that comfortable chair has a hard seat, please remember to get up and stretch every 30 minutes. If you get up and stretch every 30 minutes, do not stretch beyond your abilities. Stay within your defined stretching capacity and consult a doctor who specializes in stretching. If you do not have a doctor, listen to all the shows on the Heritage Radio Network. There has to be at least one doctor among the Heritage Radio Network podcast hosts. Thanks for listening. Agave Road Trip out.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.